Hello, friends, and welcome back to Behind the Bastards, the show where we tell you everything you don't know about the worst people in all of history. I'm your host, Robert Evans, and this week my co-host is Anna Hosnia, producer extraordinaire, co-host of the podcast Ethnically Ambiguous, and all-around woman about town. Anna, today we are talking about Harvey Weinstein.
What? Just kidding. I knew.
Yes.
Comedy.
My guests for this show come in cold. But this is a case that it is impossible to come in entirely cold on because his whole saga has been one of the biggest stories of the last couple of years.
Yeah, I couldn't help myself. I had to read all those Ronan Farrow articles about him.
Some great articles.
I'm a huge Black Cube fan, so like I was deep in there.
Oh, yeah?
Trying to get involved.
Big fan of Israeli-aligned spy agencies.
Yeah, what can I say? I'm a Mossad head.
We'll be digging into some of that, a lot of that, actually. Just as a heads up, this is going to be a two-parter episode, so if you're one of those people who hates the number two, you should be aware of that. It just wound up being a lot longer in terms of research than we had anticipated. It's one of those things where every time I would finish reading an article and set down to write, two new ones would pop up. There's just so much on this case. I would go so far as to say I can't imagine one person's crimes being better reported than Weinstein's have. But it does mean that there's a lot to talk about. So, yeah, we'll be dropping the second part of this on Thursday. I just kind of wanted to get, what is your understanding of the culpability of the people around Harvey Weinstein? Obviously, Mr. Weinstein has been accused at this point of dozens of sexual assaults, multiple rapes, spanning a period of time from the 1970s until just a couple of years ago, and probably going on before and after that. Be entirely honest, but what's your understanding of the guilt of sort of the people around him?
I do believe his company with his brother was aware of his behavior and used a lot of the resources to cover it up. I don't think his wife knew too much because I believe they lived somewhat separate lives, because people, I feel like, in that sort of industry who are so high up, you know, they spend a lot of time traveling, moving around. You know, they have busy lives, and not a lot overlaps. And I think he had a lot of money and power to cover up a lot of things. So I do think people knew, but I think it's also one of those things where you just don't touch it because you want to protect your own, like, interests. You know what I mean?
That's exactly, in fact, what we're going to be talking about today. So for those of you who are a little bit less up to date on things, I'm just going to give a brief overview of the case. In October of last year, the New York Times and the New Yorker both started publishing what would become a long series of articles about sexual assaults by Mr. Weinstein. Initially, more than a dozen women accused him of sexual harassment and assault. After the first New York Times article, more and more accusations came coming in, including accusations of rape. As of the recording of this podcast, at least 85 women have come forward with accusations. He was fired almost immediately from his job at the company that bore his name, and he's just turned himself into the NYPD. One of the things I thought was interesting about him turning himself in is he was pictured with three books. He was there for like 2 hours. You don't bring three books to read to court while you're waiting to be arraigned.
Right.
So he's holding a number of books, one of which was a biography of the director Elia Kazan. And I suspect he was trying to like signal a message by the books he was carrying, because Kazan was a very popular and well-regarded director in like the 40s and 50s, whose career was derailed by the Red Scare. He was a member of the Communist Party. He was, like, taken in by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he named names, which, like, further disgraced him. And so this biography is, like, someone looking, trying to evaluate his legacy now and sort of redeem it, because he made all these great movies, and, like, it's a tragedy that he was railroaded by this moral movement that came around and wound up in the long sweep of history being seen as, like, horribly immoral, which is clearly how Weinstein views himself.
Jesus.
That's his hope, is that he's going to get, I think he's signaling by carrying this book into court that in 30 or 40 years, people will look at me as a genius who is unfairly railroaded by a movement that, that's the message he's trying. Why else would you carry that book?
I would argue not the same thing.
Well, no. And also, like, one of the things about it that is, like, Elia Kazan, you can, like, say what you want about the morality of turning in people during the Red Scare, but he was, like, an actual creative person who made art, and it's kind of the same thing with Roman Polanski. Mm-hmm. Like, Roman Polanski, you can say, you know, the crimes he committed weren't worth the movies we got out of him, but he made movies. Weinstein was never anything but like the money guy. Like he was good at picking scripts and good at being like, oh yeah, I figure like this guy might be famous, but he didn't make any of the stuff that he's famous for. So like that's, I feel like this guy in 50 years, the most notable thing about him in the annals of history is that the accusations against him sparked this movement.
Right.
That's what he's going to be remembered for. He's not going to be remembered for anything he did as a producer, not in the long span of time.
What a piece of shit.
He's a real piece of shit. And that's kind of why when we started working on this episode, I thought it was going to be more of a dive into Weinstein's life and everything he'd done and sort of cut it apart piece by piece like that. But the more I've read about him, he's not an interesting guy. Like, he's a bastard, but he's not an interesting bastard. He's a dull, gross, boring little puddle of a man.
I feel like you can't be that interesting if you're that interested in, like, raping women.
Yeah. There's just not much to say about him other than the crimes he committed.
Right.
And a lot has been said about that. And so, and I also think this is a case where he's going to get as much justice as a rich, probable rapist can get in our society.
Yeah, he'll be playing tennis in prison.
He'll be playing tennis in prison, but also, like, it's not like Cosby, where he's getting caught right as he's too old to really understand what's going on, and he's not losing any productive years. Harvey probably would have had another 10, 20 years running a studio or, you know, running his company if he hadn't gotten caught. So his career is being cut short, and that's a good thing. This is all a long way of me saying this episode of Behind the Bastards is not going to focus on Harvey Weinstein. He's not the bastard that I think we're interested in right here. Because when you read all the articles that have been published and the interviews with everybody who was around him, it becomes clear that it took dozens, if not hundreds of people, and maybe even more, to make his behavior possible. So my initial idea with this podcast was to sort of catalog all of the different people who helped him hurt so many other people. And it over the course of my research, I did find a lot of enablers, like buildings filled with people who made this possible. But I also found a sort of foggy layer of doubt floating over everybody involved that makes me kind of uncomfortable and queasy. So it's one of the, I keep going back and forth about whether or not this episode is a good idea, but we're just going to dive into it now.
Yeah. That's interesting. It feels like when you're that powerful, like, oh God, the concept of power is one of the most terrifying things.
Yeah.
You really think about it. It almost feels like just doing something very normal, like going to get coffee and just hanging with your friends is just, it's not good enough anymore. Like once you've lived that life, like the stakes have to be raised and now it's, now, for fun, I invite women up to a hotel room and try and get them to watch me shower naked. It's like, ugh.
So you're thinking about the impact that the power had on him. I guess what I'm thinking about is everyone. Yeah, that's what I'm interested in here. There's a really famous Edmund Burke quote about the Nazis where he says that, all that's necessary for evil to thrive is for good men to do nothing. And that's a really famous quote, but I think that's almost comforting to imagine that terrible people succeed because good people don't do anything. The reality that you see in the Weinstein case is that he succeeded for so long because a lot of good people were willing to help him.
Yeah.
And knew to an extent what they were doing. So let's dig in. Harvey Weinstein was born on March 19th, 1952. He and his brother Bob co-founded Miramax. Bob has also been accused of sexual harassment. Together, they produced a number of famous movies, including Pulp Fiction, Good Will Hunting, The Lord of the Rings, and The King's Speech. In total, movies Harvey produced garnered more than 300 Oscar nominations, which is a lot of Oscar nominations. His earliest recorded victim was Hope Exner D'Amore sometime in the 70s. She was an employee of a concert production company that he ran at the time. They were doing a job in Manhattan and staying in a hotel. Harvey allegedly told her there'd been a booking mix-up and they'd have to share a room. Then he allegedly raped her. His most recent reported assault was in March of 2015 when he allegedly groped Ambra Batilana. That's the bird's eye view of Harvey Weinstein's career as both a production guy and a rapist.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So in between those two assaults, possibly before and after, there were dozens and dozens of other women. Some claim they were groped. Some claim they were raped. The allegations of Lauren Sivan are pretty standard. She's a journalist who claims Weinstein lured her into an empty restaurant he part owned and then hit on her. She says that when she turned him down, he put his body between her and the exit, told her to, quote, stand there and shut up, end quote, and then masturbated into a potted plant.
As you do.
As you do.
When a woman turns you down.
Yeah. So Armin Amiri was the manager of that restaurant at the time when this happened. And when Siven came forward with her story last October, he came forward too, because while he hadn't seen that incident, he realized that he'd seen Harvey do something similar. There's a quote from him. "What I remember about this incident is that my sous chef came into my office furious, telling me that, quote, some fat fuck saying he's an owner, he didn't know the name, had come into the kitchen with a woman and shoved a $100 bill at him and told him to get out."
Ugh.
So, yeah.
So even in kitchens with people around?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, God, I mean, Harvey, people cook. People have to eat that food.
Oh, it's about to get worse. If that's what's icking you out about this story, it's about to get even worse. So according to Armin hears this from the chef. The chef is like, yeah this fat fuck just gave me $100 and shoved me out of the kitchen. So he goes back into the kitchen with the chef, and he witnessed Weinstein, quote, fixing his belt. And then said, quote, "The chef picks up a pot that had been placed on the stove. It had been defiled. It was so bizarre, we couldn't believe it happened."
He jizzed in a pot. Oh, my God.
In a potted plant at the same restaurant.
Ew. I hope they burn that pot, because that is the most unsanitary.
I feel like you burn the restaurant at this point. Because
that point.
If there are two stories of him ejaculating into random objects at this restaurant he owned.
Yeah,
he came on every square inch of that place.
Everything you lift up is like, is that jizz?
Is that jizz? Is that cum? Oh, God.
Yeah, this whole place is covered in jizz.
These tablecloths were black this morning.
Everything. Oh.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What's the restaurant's name?
Oh, geez. I don't think it's operational anymore.
Ugh, it better not be.
Yeah. So that's kind of a good microcosm of the sort of things he got up to, but it also gives you an idea of how many people are involved when you start talking about complicity, because is that sous chef a little complicit? That particular case, it doesn't sound like it, because Harvey was just shoving money at him and saying, get the fuck out of here.
Right, but if he didn't know that the woman was dragged in there, because you don't really know in a situation
exactly. It's really unclear. And Armin said something like that. It's like, I didn't say anything about it because I didn't know anything about the woman involved. I had no idea what was going on. It was just some rich guy paying to masturbate in a pot that he technically owned.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, it's a little messed up. Armin does claim that after Lauren Siven's plant story went viral, Weinstein called him and asked him to deny that he'd ever done anything like that.
Ugh.
Of course, by that point, the Harvey Weinstein name was as muddy as names get. Armin refused to do as he asked. But that was a time when it was easy to say no to Harvey Weinstein, because
at that point, he was on his way down.
Exactly, which is nothing against Armin. Maybe he would have done the right thing if he'd known something was wrong in the moment. I don't know the guy. But what is important is that for more than 30 years, almost everyone that Harvey Weinstein asked to keep his secret was happy to help him do it. David J. Pecker is the CEO of American Media, Inc. They are, do you know?
Yes.
Okay, what does
familiar
that mean?
Familiar with him. I'm familiar that he's also on Trump's team and has some friends in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, he's got friends in Saudi Arabia, he's on Trump's team, and he is, American Media, Inc., is the company that's responsible for a number of magazines, including the National Enquirer, which it just so happens that the studio we're in has a lot of issues of the Enquirer, and the one I'm looking at right now, the big title of the story is, "Exhume JonBenet's Body Now!" So that's... they're classy people, the Enquirer. Yeah, so David J. Pecker is the CEO of American Media, Inc. They own the National Enquirer, Weekly World News, etc. Harvey Weinstein and Pecker have been good friends for years. Their friendship was so deep that Harvey became known as an FOP, or Friend of Pecker, which, they're not great at acronyms.
It could easily have been Friend of Penis.
Friend of Penis. I mean, that's basically what Friend of Pecker means.
Yeah.
Friend of David. Yeah, like why Pecker? Yeah, that's a status he apparently shared with President Trump. And when you are a friend of Pecker, you get special treatment from not just the Enquirer and the Weekly World News, but the whole tabloid industry.
Right.
So I'll be listing all the sources for this podcast on our website. This info right now comes from a New York Times article entitled "Weinstein's Complicity Machine." Quote, "American media was known to sometimes help out allies in trouble with a strategy known in tabloid newsrooms as catch and kill, acquiring exclusive rights to damaging stories and then not publishing them." So basically, like, this is the first and the clearest case of another person involved who's definitely a bastard, because fucking Pecker that's not helping Harvey for money. It's not helping him because you're afraid he'll fuck up your career. It's helping him because he's your buddy and you want him to keep his sexual assaults under wrap. Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker laid out a very active relationship between the Enquirer and Weinstein. He talked to a woman named Elizabeth Avalon, who is the former wife of Robert Rodriguez. Rodriguez left her for Rose McGowan. So obviously there's understandable kind of bad blood between the two ladies. Rose claims that Harvey Weinstein raped her in his hotel room during the Sundance Festival. Mm-hmm. An Enquirer reporter figured Avalon might have some dirt on Rose McGowan. And of course, it was his job as an Enquirer reporter to dig up dirt on anyone accusing anything of Harvey Weinstein to try to discredit them. So he started calling Avalon. He called her over and over and over again. And then he started reaching out to people she knew, like friends and family, just kind of harassing them until she agreed for an interview. So Avalon sits down for an interview with this reporter, and he repeatedly pushes her to say bad things about Rose McGowan. She wanted to make sure that the call was off the record and only for deep background, and the reporter said that it was, but he recorded the whole thing. And afterwards, he handed a recording to American Media's chief content officer, Dylan Howard, who emailed it to Harvey Weinstein and said, quote, "I have something," all caps, "amazing!" Eventually, she laid into Rose pretty hard, which, again, that's American Media's chief content officer talking. Weinstein replied to him, quote, "This is the killer, especially if my fingerprints are," just the letter R, "not on this," end quote. Howard assured him that the fingerprints weren't on it and said, "This conversation is," all caps, "recorded."
Okay, I'm sorry. He wrote just the letter R?
Yeah, my fingerprints are not on this.
What? That's more... Yeah, you type out
the whole word fingerprints, and but you don't have time for the R.
That's stupid.
I know. There's a lot of reasons to hate the man. Howard's definitely culpable here.
Yeah.
Like, that's gross behavior. And for what it's worth, like, Avalon, during the call, said some not pleasant things about Rose McGowan, because understandably, like, they had a history. She has expressed a lot of regret about it and is obviously... has solidarity for her for the whole being horribly abused by Harvey Weinstein thing. So yeah, that's fucked up for a lot of reasons, because you're not just trying to bury the accusations of a woman who was harmed. You're like playing on somebody's heartbreak and pain in order to, like, it's almost impossible to, like, look at something like a sexual assault and be like, how can I make this worse?
Mm-hmm.
But
just use a bunch of women and
dry
them out and then hope it helps protect a man who is trash.
Yeah, it's almost like a work of art in terms of being shitty people. Like, it took a lot of garbage all coming together to make this landfill. So yeah, Pecker and Howard are both pieces of crap, as well as the reporter who did that hatchet job. I feel like that's also a bad guy. There are going to be a lot of terrible reporters in this story. But so we're already up to at least three or four other complicit people, plus...
Was this reporter someone who worked for, like, Enquirer?
Yeah. It was an Enquirer reporter.
Why would she ever talk to an Enquirer reporter, it just seems?
Because he kept calling her family and friends.
So she finally was like, fine, I'll talk to you.
If you won't talk to anyone else, I will talk to you. Like, that's where it got.
Ugh.
Just when we're talking about just the press, there are dozens of people implicated in keeping Harvey's secrets. And we're going to get into another one of those stories in a minute. But right now... we got to sell some stuff. You like stuff, right?
Huge fan.
You got wallets and money. Anyway,
yes.
Go grab some money. Grab as much money as you can, and then tune into these ads. We're back, and we are talking about Harvey Weinstein, or rather the people who enabled him to do the things that he did, all of the other bastards in the Harvey Weinstein story. We just talked about two guys, Pecker and Howard, who both ran the company that owned the National Enquirer, and the Enquirer essentially helped dig up dirt on Weinstein's accusers. Now we're going to talk about another story in that vein. In 2014, Emily Nestor was working as a temporary employee for the Weinstein Company. She'd been there a day when Weinstein promised to help her career if she fucked him.
The old classic, I'll help your career if you fuck me.
I mean, he waited a good 3 or 4 hours, which is a lot of restraint for Harvey Weinstein. She turned him down, and then he made her keep turning him down for more than an hour. Emily complained to her coworkers, and they did the right thing. They reported it to management in a formal complaint thingy was made.
And this is the company he owns. So yeah, management the is company. Just means nothing really. Because,
well, no, there's other people. It's a big company. Like there are other people. And as we'll get into, there was some resistance from within the corporate structure to Harvey. Like the company bore his name, but he was not in absolute, it was too big a company to be in absolute control of.
I hope so.
Although obviously he had a lot of power. Anyway, other people report it. A formal complaint thing is made, and eventually the matter does get to Harvey. He invited Nestor to breakfast right after that. And I'm going to quote from another Ronan Farrow New Yorker article here. Throughout the breakfast, she said, Weinstein interrupted their conversation to yell into his cell phone, enraged over a spat that Amy Adams, a star in the Weinstein movie Big Eyes, was having in the press. Afterward, Weinstein told Nestor to keep an eye on the news cycle, which he promised would be spun in his favor. Later in the day, there were indeed negative news items about his opponents, and Weinstein stopped by Nestor's desk to be sure she'd seen them. By that point, Nestor recalled, I was very afraid of him, and I knew how well-connected he was, and how if I pissed him off, then I could never have a career in that industry.
Oh, God, that's heartbreaking.
Well, yeah, it's heartbreaking, and I wonder how knowledgeable the people who are... So, like, I feel like a guy like Howard, who owns American... or who's the CEO of American Media, mm-hmm. has to know what this... Because obviously, if he's helping his buddy out with this, he's used his organs of press for the same sort of... purposes. So
right.
He knows what this looks like on a human level, and he probably gets off on the power of that too. I don't know about a guy like Howard who directs the reporter to like find the dirt. I don't know about the reporter, like if they really, like maybe you don't let yourself think about it, like what you're a part
True.
Of.
True. I'm sure there's some level of disassociation from what you're really doing in order to get your job done. But even so, like I couldn't imagine working a job like that. It just seems like so, like you would be dead on the inside.
Soul crushing. To know that what you're doing, you're interviewing someone, not even for an article, you're interviewing someone so that some like greasy fuck in a suit can exercise his power over a, what, 20-year-old woman who has a 1/1,000,000,000th of the wealth that he has.
Right.
So this guy can feel powerful in front of her. Like that's what you're putting in 8-hour days for, is so some dirtbag you've never met can feel powerful.
Right.
Like how do you do that? And like is that I mean, when it comes to like what would be justice, is the fact that you had to be that guy and probably have to drink being that guy away every night of your life, is that punishment? Like I don't know.
I wonder, or I don't know, maybe they just hire like a group of like sociopaths who don't feel empathy to work for them. Like in the interview, they just ask you a series of questions to kind of nail down the type of person you are and if you're willing to do the work that needs to be done to get the information that needs to be gotten.
Well, and as I look at this Whoa. National Enquirer article in front of me, one of the other article titles is, I'm not your real father, Harry. Prince Charles drops wedding bombshell.
Actually, if you look deep into that, there are some points they make that are quite convincing.
So, it is one of those things, though. Like, obviously, anyone, these people, we're calling them reporters, but you should put quotation marks around the word reporter because they work for the Enquirer. But, like, I don't know, maybe part of the mistake is with me and feeling like the fucking shit in these rags was ever kind of lighthearted. Like, you think about, like, oh, Bat Boy, you know, they're talking about kooky fun. Like, it's... That was my mom's explanation to me as a kid when I would see these insane things. And I'd be like, Mom, is Saddam Hussein really going to murder our president? And she'd be like, no, it's the National Enquirer. Everything in it is a lie. Why does it exist? Oh, because people think it's fun to read.
Oh.
Yeah. Now I
guess, when I was young, they used to have a lot of like Catwoman on it.
Yeah,
that lady.
It would be wacky stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fucking moon Nazis.
Yeah.
So Nestor, you know, took a settlement and left the company and didn't pursue the matter any further because she was like, if I make a deal about this, then Harvey Weinstein's going to drag my name through the mud in the press.
Right. Did they make her sign an NDA?
Yeah, I'm sure they did. This story is full of NDAs. Like almost everybody that you're going to run into who had a settlement or even who's speaking out now had an NDA at one point. Like, I guess it's one of those things that at this point the NDAs aren't worth that much, but they clearly held the dam together for a while.
Yeah.
So Weinstein had what the New York Times described as a network of friendly journalists, gossip columnists, magazine writers, editors, and authors that he knew would help him by publishing articles that attacked his enemies. These aren't all through the National Enquirer. They're not all through Howard. Like he's a high placed guy in the film industry, so he's dealing with press all the time because that's an important part of his legitimate job, is like building up interest and whatnot in the projects he's working on. So he just knew a lot of people that he could call and plant stories to. Like if he wants to make someone look bad, whether because they're accusing him or because he just wants to punish them, well, he's got probably hundreds of guys on the line. And you have to wonder how many of them even knew what they were a part of. Like Harvey Weinstein calls you and he's got a legitimate scoop about another famous person. Do you think, why is he leaking this to me? Or do you just run with a story?
Like, oh, Harvey's on the line.
Yeah, Harvey's on the line. He's got another scoop about Rose McGowan. People want to read about Rose McGowan doing something. Like, maybe you...
Being crazy somewhere, that not whatever he's made up.
Yeah, so do you even... That's where the complicity gets hard for me. Like, it's easy in a case like the email exchange between the Inquirer guys that we talked about, where it's someone being like, go after this person, get dirt on Rose McGowan, bring it back so that we have something to hold over her head. That seems clear. But a lot of there's probably people who are right now journalists and gossip writers who are just figuring like, oh my God, how many of the stories that I wrote based on scoops that he or his people gave me were part of this? And
that's what I don't understand. It's like, I mean, maybe I didn't know about it because I don't, in my life, I have not ever come across Harvey Weinstein outside of just knowing he's a movie producer. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand how, if anyone even heard rumors about him being like a creep and a rapist and just like overall power mongering psycho, I don't know. It's hard for me to understand, like, not stepping away and be like, oh, I've heard a lot of bad things about this person. Like, maybe I shouldn't be involved. And I guess that's what you're talking about. It's like, because I feel like if you're so far removed from him, like you're working at a paper and Harvey calls and he's got
team
this,
Z or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, doesn't feel like he could affect you that much. I mean, maybe he can, but I feel like you should be able to just step away and be like, you know what, this is not a story I'm going to work on.
But maybe you don't, like, he's not coming to you saying like, hey, I need to make this lady look bad, here's some dirt on her. He's saying like, hey, you want a story?
And
like,
as more of a
scoop. Reporter, yeah, you're always like, your job, you're always short on stuff to write about, you're always looking for the next thing to cover. This well-connected guy comes to you with a story.
Yeah, but even if you've heard the rumors,
I mean, I don't know. But what are the rumors you're hearing? They're probably not Harvey Weinstein's a rapist, especially if you're a male reporter. That's probably not what you're hearing. You're hearing Harvey Weinstein's a womanizer. Harvey Weinstein's an asshole with a temper.
Yeah, maybe I just hate men, so I'm just out here not trying to help anybody.
Well, this is not a story that will increase your faith in men or your faith in journalists. Mm. So Weinstein owned a publishing house. And one of the things you run across in just sort of the stories of how he would manipulate people is he offered, and in some cases gave, shitloads of people book deals. Like, that was a common way. If you were a reporter that he really wanted to get to do some work for him, and work that was definitely going to be questionable, this is how he would get over your professional scruples or over your reticence to work with him. So, like, it's one thing for Harvey to give you a call and be like, hey, I got this story about so-and-so, you know, maybe you write it. And it's another thing for him to be like, I want you to help me gather dirt on this person, which is what happened to a New York Daily News columnist named A.J. Benza. So Weinstein invited Benza out to dinner in West Hollywood and told him, in short, that he needed help in keeping his mistress secret when he divorced his wife. Benza was on board for this and recalled to the New York Times that Harvey had said, quote, I could supply your PR, or that he said to Harvey. So this is, Harvey's like, hey, I'm divorcing my wife, but it's not set up yet. I've got a mistress. I need to keep this shit on the down low. And AJ Benza says to him, I could supply your PR girls with a lot of gossip, a lot of stories. And if people come at them with the Harvey's having an affair story, they can barter. Mr. Benza says, Weinstein replied, AJ, it's got to be good stories. And AJ said, don't you worry about it. So that's how these conversations are apparently looking.
So they're basically like, hey, instead of publishing this, why don't you look at this over here. Wow. So it's a lot of is red herring the correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the correct term. So it's a lot of, And so he's finding people who are well connected, because like a guy like Benza, he knows what people in the Daily News, and he probably has friends at other rags of similar. So he knows, oh, this guy's working on a story that might implicate Weinstein in an affair or some other bad behavior. What if I promise to give him two or three stories about somebody else? Like, that's what Benz is offering to do for Weinstein. And that's how a lot of this gets done. Now, Benza claims he didn't know about any of the rape accusations or the sexual assaults, and that's possible. Most of the people in this story who enabled Weinstein in one way or the other are folks like Benza. They're people whose defense to moral culpability is that they just thought Harvey Weinstein was a gross person, not a rapist. So, and Benza, again, there was like a book deal on the line. Like that was what Harvey was giving him, is he was like, I'm going to get you like a fucking book out of this, which I can say when I think about like what I would do in his situation. It's easy to say, like, no, of course I wouldn't take that deal. But back before I'd had a book deal, like, part of me wonders if I just thought this guy was trying to keep his affair under wraps, maybe you do it. Maybe you do it and you cringe and you tell yourself that getting the book out will make it okay because you've got something to say or whatever.
There would always be this ickiness in the back of your mind, thinking you didn't fully get it from your own worth ethic.
No, and that's... That's what I wonder with, and we'll talk about Ben Affleck in a little bit, but about the people who legitimately have to credit a lot of their fame and success to Harvey Weinstein in their early, it's like how they, because a lot of them knew something was up and didn't do it. And again, like, is there that feeling of like, is that why Ben Affleck has a terrible back tattoo and drinks too much?
Probably.
Because he knows that he's a
I think Ben Affleck knows a lot of things that are slowly killing him.
Man, that actually does make him a great candidate to play Batman.
Yeah. Dark past.
Yeah. He might be the most appropriate casting of Batman that we could have gotten.
Poor Benny.
Yeah. Well, no. not in any way, shape, or form.
No.
Okay. Now that we've talked about AJ Benza. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, what's your viewing on Benza's moral culpability here? Like, is that, how gross is that? If he really just thought he was helping a man hide an affair.
Oh, I mean, that's something I would not be interested in. So it's hard for me to separate my own like dislike of that kind of situation from him. So that's my problem, is like taking this book deal. You know why you got that book deal. It's not because you're the like someone wanted you because you're so great at writing.
Voice or
you have this story or whatever. It's because you helped a man cover up an affair like that. Doesn't feel right to me. Doesn't sit right.
Okay, but do you have any student loans?
No.
Okay. Did you ever at some point? Was that like a thing? Was that like a cross you had to bear?
No, my parents do well for themselves.
Okay, sorry. I didn't mean to get super personal. I had a bunch
okay.
of student loans that were cleared off when I got a book deal.
Okay.
And so it was one of those things. There was obviously like a creative, like that's something I always wanted to have a book in the library. That was a huge thing for me from like a kid. But it was also like, I can get under the weight of this crushing debt in one fell swoop if I get someone to buy my book. I don't know that Benza had something like that going on, but I can see how that would be almost impossible to turn.
When you put it that way, it's like that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's hard for me to put myself in that person's position. So immediately I have this disdain, like, why would you do that? But of course, I don't know where that person's background is. I don't know if he had a mother in the hospital. I don't know anything
about
him.
Exactly. Who he had, maybe he had to pay medical bills for someone or for himself.
Yeah.
Like, I can say in AJ Benza's defense, and I don't know if he actually knew about maybe he knew more than he says he did, but if he didn't know about the assaults and the rapes, I can imagine myself being in a situation where I would help a creepy rich guy cover up an affair for enough money to pay for my romantic partner to get health care or whatever kind of shit, like deal with some crippling, like... I want to condemn him, and like to an extent, you got to, because Harvey Weinstein raped dozens of people probably.
That's
but
the
also,
problem. It's like,
yeah.
In the long run, though,
yeah.
the things that came out would weigh heavy on him. If he feels empathy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He does work for the New York Daily News, so maybe he's had the empathy burned out of him by this point.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like I said, I got into this wanting to just condemn a whole list of people, and it's hard with almost every one of these. Which brings me organically to Harvey Weinstein's co-workers at the Weinstein Company, or I should say employees. In 2004, Lucia Stoller, now Lucia Evans, no relation to
Did she change her name or did she just get married?
She got married.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm going to call her Lucia Evans just because that's what she goes by now. It'll be less confusing. Mm-hmm. She met Harvey Weinstein at a club when she was a sophomore in college. He called her in the middle of the night and suggested that she meet him in his office to talk about her career. She did the very savvy, smart thing and said she only did readings during the day and for a casting director, right? So she's making all the right moves at this point. So Harvey has his assistant call her and set up a daytime meeting. first with Weinstein and then with a female casting director who worked for him. So this assistant calls and says, okay, you're going to have a meeting. You're going to come in. You're going to talk to Harvey. And then you're going to talk to so-and-so, this lady who was a casting director, which seems legitimate.
Yeah.
And that's what she was like, oh, a woman. Great. I feel safe. Like, you're not just meeting with Harvey. This isn't, he wants you privately in his room. Like, he's going to talk to you, probably to let you know how the process works, and then he's going to put you with a casting director who's a lady. This all feels legit.
God, I feel so nervous.
So she arrives at the meeting, and it's just Harvey Weinstein alone in a room full of exercise equipment and takeout food boxes, which I'm assuming didn't smell great. God, just looking at Harvey Weinstein.
Like? Yeah. What in the world? You just eat and then maybe work out, but maybe it's just there to look at, so you think at some point you'll work out?
I feel like most of that equipment never got used.
No, there's no way.
Yeah, but that's the kind of thing you can do when you're that rich. In addition to having people cover up your assaults, you'd be like, bring the exercise bike into the meeting room. I'm gonna get in shape. Like, fucking Harvey Weinstein. Go on a jog, asshole. So she gets into this creepy room, and Weinstein immediately starts alternating between praising and insulting her. He'll make comments like, you know, you'd be great for this role if you'd lose some weight, that sort of thing. So he's like, he's doing the dropping the negging or whatever you call it. He told her that he had two projects in mind for her, and then he forced her to give him oral sex, overpowering her physically when she told him to stop. Harvey acted like the encounter was no big deal. Evans wondered how his other employees could not know what was going on. After that meeting, she did meet with a female casting director who sent her scripts and watched her do a read several weeks later. Evans doesn't think the casting director was in on it, but it's hard to say. So that's one of those things. Like, she might have been helping him do this without even knowing it, because she wasn't in that initial meeting. She was just being used essentially as cover, and he had her do the work.
God, the casting director. That's too hard to believe that they have no sense of what's going on, you know?
Because
don't people exit and look frazzled, like, ugh?
And there must have been people who saw her. And that's why I assume she says she can't imagine they didn't know what was going on, because she probably walked out of that room horrified and traumatized, and, like, people wouldn't meet her eye. But it's one of those, the sheer weight of encounters like this, and it sounds like there might have been hundreds over the time that he was, you know, over the 20 or 30 years. And I'll say this, from everything I can read, there's a couple of things you find out. Number one, a good number of them would have been consensual. You know, obviously there's the fucked up power dynamic of he's got a bunch of money and he holds the key for your career, but he didn't have to physically force them. There were a lot of them were people who were like, oh, okay, the deal is I fuck you and then I get a part in a movie. And there are people who were down for that. So that happened. I think a lot of this would be telling yourself that that's what's happening in order to feel better about it. But you work for Harvey. You don't say, oh, he's assaulting another woman. You say, that's Harvey Weinstein. He's sleeping with somebody else, and she's going to get a role doing something.
Right.
So maybe that's part of what was going on in their head. But I do feel like some of these women clearly came out looking traumatized.
So I just died a little.
Yeah. It's rough. God. And it's another one of the – like, it obviously is messed up, like asking random people to meet you in hotel rooms and apartments. But people who were just legitimate business partners of Harvey's, who condemn him and stuff right now also say, like, that's what he did with everybody. Like, if you were working
everyone
with Harvey,
to meet with him.
You would meet with him at random hours of the night in his hotel or his apartment. That was just, like, the style of predator he was. But I'm going to guess that evolved naturally out of the kind of person he was, rather than he's not just inviting these people, because obviously he's willing to assault them at the office. But that's also camouflages it, because then nobody thinks it's weird that Harvey has these young actresses meeting him at whatever hotel, because everybody meets him at the hotel.
Yeah. There's not too much suspicion.
although, again, like, it happened so often that at some point they had to know they were lying to themselves a little bit. And speaking of lying to yourselves a little bit, it's time to break for ads. And so rather than ranting about the evils of money, which is really easy to do on a podcast about Harvey Weinstein, a man who bought his way into raping dozens of people, I would like to sell you guys some cool products.
That was smooth.
Okay. So we just talked about how Lucia Evans met him in 2004, and he tricked her into meeting her alone in a conference room and then forced her to give him oral sex. And we're kind of wondering about complicity, because there was part of why she felt safe in going there is a female casting director was promised to be there. So it's hard to say if that casting director knew what was going on. Evans doesn't think she did. But it's definite that some of his assistants, Weinstein's assistants, were complicit and knew more or less what was going on. I'm going to quote here from the New York Times article, Harvey Weinstein's Complicity Machine. Quote, some low-level assistants were pulled in. They compiled Bibles that included hints on facilitating encounters with women and were required to procure his penile injections for erectile dysfunction. End quote. Yeah. Yeah. Did these assistants know Harvey was a rapist? It's hard to say. Most of the Weinstein Company people who have talked will insist that they just thought Harvey was an abusive creep and not a sex predator. A group of like 30 of them sent a statement into the New Yorker, which I'm going to read now. We all knew that we were working for a man with an infamous temper. We did not know that we were working for a serial sexual predator. We knew that our boss could be manipulative. We did not know that he used his power to systematically assault and silence women. We had an idea that he was a womanizer who had extramarital affairs. We did not know he was a violent aggressor or an alleged rapist. So that's kind of their defense to moral culpability. It's, again, it's the same as Benz's. I knew he was a piece of shit. I didn't think he was raping women.
Right, because I guess once that door closes, your position in the company doesn't really allow you to know too much more. But still, it's just, God, I would lose my mind if I was one of those assistants today.
Well, and some of them definitely knew what was going on behind that closed door. There is a story in a New Yorker article by Dana Goodyear that makes me heavily doubt that they weren't sure what was going on. It's from a woman who went to work at the Weinstein Company and applied for a position that would have put her very close to Harvey. I think she was going to be one of his assistants if she got this job. And she recalled to the New Yorker that a female executive took her aside and said that she was too pretty to work for Weinstein because she would embarrass him.
Oh, boy.
She continued to push for the job, and so a former Weinstein assistant took her to lunch and said, quote, do not take this job. You will see things you will never be able to unsee, and you will do things you will never forgive yourself for.
Wait, so was she kind of being like, you're too pretty for him, you'll embarrass him, to just be like, that was like an excuse to be like, trust me, just don't.
Yeah, that was the executive trying to nicely keep her away from this job. And then when that didn't work, they were like, okay, get the lady who had the job and have her be like don't fucking
do this.
You're
so pretty, he will come for you.
Yeah.
That is terrifying.
So it's clear from that the people who worked with Harvey both knew he was a predator and were aware enough of how dangerous he was that they would protect people when they could.
Yeah.
Or if they liked you and knew you, they would try to keep you away from him. And that, I mean, it's nice that this lady was saved from a bad situation, but it's kind of damning for a lot of these people on a moral level, because then they weren't unsure of what was happening behind them. You don't warn someone away from a job like that unless you know, oh, you're going to get fucking assaulted if you get close to him.
Oh, God, that is the worst. That's the unfortunate thing. I wish they'd use that language instead of trying to, like, protect the situation. Just be like, honey, if you take this job, he will try and have sex with you. And that is that.
Not he will try. He will find a way to have sex with you if it means holding you down.
Yeah.
That's what he does. We all know it and we still work here. Please don't judge it. Which is, that's a harder conversation to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of people in this story who I have to assume have spent the last 20 years drinking themselves to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
In his first big article on Weinstein, Ronan Farrow noted that 16 former and current executives and assistants who'd worked with or for Weinstein had told him about, quote, unwanted sexual advances and touching, unquote, that they'd witnessed at work. So again, that's not closed door stuff. That's people telling a journalist, like, I saw him touch a lady and she wasn't having it. She did not want it. It was clearly not okay. That number included employees who were, quote, enlisted in a subterfuge to make the victims feel safe. These are referred to in a lot of the reporting as honeypots, which is like a spy term for, like, I feel like that. This is Ronan Farrow's great, incredible journalism, deserves a Pulitzer and all that. I feel like honeypot is the wrong term for this, because that's a term you use for like a sexy lady spy.
Yeah, and she like seduces the guy to get him, get what she needs from him.
And these, the women that Harvey uses to lure other women into feeling safe of getting close to Harvey.
It's not really honeypotting.
It's not a honeypot. I don't know what
that's
term you use.
That's more just like emotional manipulation using women to...
It's camouflage.
Yeah.
It's rapist camouflage.
Yeah, be like, look, you can trust another woman.
There's another lady in here. Ugh. Nothing's bad has ever happened in a room with two ladies and a creepy man.
Jesus.
Several female employees, assistants, and executives would sometimes join meetings with Weinstein and a woman he was interested in. And then at some point midway through the meeting, Weinstein would dismiss them and they would all leave him alone with his victim. One female executive explained, quote, "There was a large volume of these types of meetings that Harvey would have with aspiring actresses and models. He would have them late at night, usually at hotel bars or in hotel rooms. And in order to make these women feel more comfortable, he would ask a female executive or assistant to start these meetings with him." So, that's...
So at one point they would just excuse themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Or Harvey would make it clear that it was time for them to excuse themselves. And then they'd all leave. Which, Jesus. That's... culpability right there.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You're party to a crime. Not that I think any of these people are ever going to get charged, but if they were, they deserve it, mm-hmm. I guess. Like, I don't even feel good. Like, I want to...
Even they could have just walked behind him and been like, get her.
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. So the woman who related that last quote insisted that she never participated in any of these honeypot meetings, although she said she was asked to do so. But at least one former employee did come forward to Ronan Farrow to admit to being used as a honeypot. She reported that in one of these meetings, like she was sitting down at a meeting with Weinstein and some lady Weinstein wanted to get with. And midway through the meeting, Weinstein turned to her while he'd been flirting with this lady and said, "Tell her how good of a boyfriend I am."
Ooh.
So like that's again, it doesn't sound like these were just we're being camouflaged. It's we're being camouflaged and we're trying to help our boss hit on strangers.
Yeah. They're like wingmanning him.
Yeah, they're like wingmanning him into sex crimes. And so again, I really want to get judgmental about these people and maybe I should be really like I came into this podcast wanting to do that. But they all, when you read anyone who worked with him now, their comments on it, they all seemed like they were so scared.
Yeah.
Which makes it harder for me to have that kind of righteous anger you want in a story about a bunch of people enabling a mass rapist.
Mm-hmm.
That former employee, the one who was a honeypot, said that he's been systematically doing this for a very long time. And she said that she often thinks about one time when Harvey whispered to himself, as far as she could tell, after he like shouted at a bunch of people and you know just had one of his like temper tantrums, "There are things I've done that nobody knows." Like he started like shouting and screaming, and then like at the end of it was just like repeating that to himself.
To me, if I heard that, that's a wrap. That is a wrap. That's a crazy person.
He's saying that after you know some of the things he's done.
Yeah.
Like if you don't know every word, you know,
because
every
that shows his self awareness that he knows goddamn well that he is ruining people.
Yeah.
And he does not give a fuck. And then that saying that to almost be like, "Don't fuck with me. I've done things." It's ew.
Well, and there's stories he's threatened to kill people. I think it was Selma Hayek who said that he made like some sort of comment like, "I could have you killed" during an argument.
Right, because she like stood up to him.
Yeah, she wouldn't have sex with him to make the Frida Kahlo movie.
Uh-huh.
And he made like a bunch of ridiculous demands. And he was like, "Well, okay, if we're still going to make this, you have to find $10 million in funding on your own." And this and she like met all of these demands. And so then he made her do a topless sex scene with another woman in the movie, which she said she did because she didn't want to see everybody else's work put away.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but anyway, like, and he would regularly, when you read any of these articles about him, there's people will talk about the threats he would make. And it was more common for him to make threats like, "I can destroy your reputation. I can get, like, I know people. I can get you in the news. Like, this will be, we've already covered a lot of that." So these women who were acting as honeypots, who knew that they were luring other women into a dangerous man's embrace, were also, like, terrified of him. And mm-hmm. I don't know how much that reduces their guilt. It doesn't make it fun to judge
sometimes
them.
You just have no choice or your life will be over, and that's what sucks. It's like you can't judge them because of his power, but part of you also kind of wishes they did a little bit more to make it clear. Like,
they certainly had a chance to be heroes, and they didn't take it. I don't know how much of a villain that makes them, but people got hurt because of their actions. One of the women, it's probably worth noting, that the New York Times interviewed who Weinstein had assaulted, Ashley Mathau. She was a dancer in one of his films, and she said that his assistant kind of pushed her into a car and told her that she was going to have a meeting with Weinstein for business purposes in a hotel room. And when she got to the room, Weinstein pushed her on a bed and masturbated on her. She has a much colder picture of how all of the people around him acted.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like they're so disassociated.
Yeah. She says that she was crying and his female assistant wouldn't even acknowledge her, and that it all seemed like a well-oiled machine. So when you
so dark.
Yeah, and again, when you listen to these women, or in, a lot of them are women, but like any of the people who worked with him, they all point out how scared they all were. But then you talk about the experiences of the women that Harvey assaulted who were on the other end of this machine that he constructed, and it seemed to him just a bunch of people following orders, coldly, not willing to look you in the eye, which again makes me think
that's evil.
Yeah, and I'm too sympathetic for these people who are willing to do this.
That's so evil. To not even acknowledge a woman crying that you clearly put in that situation is, oh God.
Yeah.
Deserve nothing. That's so terrible.
And again, you might come back around here with what I'm about to talk to, because some of Weinstein's assistants did resist. Michelle Franklin confronted Weinstein about his behavior. He told her that her opinion didn't count, and he fired her. It seems like most of the employees who went along with Harvey's behavior did so out of a mix of a need and a desire for money and a fear that he could destroy their career forever. A good case study in this is an assistant named Sandeep Rahal. Part of her job was to keep him supplied with the injectable erection drugs Cabraject and Alprostadil.
Injectable, so you could just shoot up real quick.
You got to shoot them into your... Most of these, I think, you have to shoot into your dick.
Straight into it, like the veins.
Oof. I know that some of them... I've talked to a lot of porn industry people who will use Trimex, which is a gel that you shoot right into your dick, because it's like it's like guaranteed. Like if you have to perform for a camera, like it'll make it happen. And if I'm remembering correctly, one of his initial defenses to why he couldn't have raped some of these women is that, like, well, I'm not in good health. I can't even get erect. I was like, yeah, you had people paying you to shoot your dick.
Yeah.
So anyway, getting Harvey his dick drugs was part of Ms. Rahal's unofficial duties. And when she talked to the New York Times, Ms. Rahal recalled that Harvey had an in-depth knowledge of her personal life. Ugh. He'd regularly bring up her student loans. He mentioned that he knew her younger sister, where she went to school, and that he could have her kicked out of that school. And he offered her an extra $500 every time she supplied him with his erection drugs. So he
had info on everybody.
Yeah. And it's entirely possible Ms. Rahal was, I don't know how the time frames link up, but she would have been one of these women probably not looking in the eyes of another woman who Harvey had just assaulted.
Right.
Does the fact that she thought like her sister might get kicked out of school or Harvey could fuck up her financial
life?
Like, see, and then I come back around to like, they're obviously more victims. I guess the question is like how bad are they too?
That's the thing, is they're victims of the industry, of like a system that is uncontrollable.
Yeah, and that's part of Weinstein's evil, was building a machine to help him do this rather than like Cosby. There were some people who sort of helped keep it under wraps, but it wasn't anything like this. Like for the most part, it was one guy and some fucking roofies assaulting a ton of women. Weinstein built an engine. But also, the pieces of that engine are culpable. Yeah.
It feels like almost every part of that engine could have fallen apart at any point, though, because people were probably losing their minds.
Yeah, and Ms. Rahal says that like part of her job was to clean semen stains off of his couch, and he would grope her constantly like while she would do pretty much anything. She's,
oh
I think, suing
God.
Him now. So she's clearly a victim, but like she's also helping this? Like, what are you...
That's so crazy to me.
Yeah, it's fucked. It's totally fucked.
If anyone ever touched me in the workplace, I'll make it very clear right now to all my coworkers listening, I will burn this place to the ground. That's crazy to me. Ugh, cleaning semen. That is...
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and think about, like, I'm trying not to delve too much into Harvey's mind in this because fuck that guy, but, like, the kind of entitlement it is to get cum stains on a couch and then make your employee clean them.
Yeah, Jesus Christ, man.
It's super gross. So now that we've entered the realm of really unclear bastards, let's swing back to somebody who is clearly a bad person in this, or a bad group of people, I should say. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the whole DA's office. Well, everyone who's involved in this part. So in the Bill Cosby podcast, we talked about how Bill's status as America's dad and most beloved entertainer probably contributed to the police, I think also in New York, choosing to ignore early reports of predatory behavior about him just because they were like, no, we're not going to go after Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
Harvey Weinstein is kind of the opposite case. He's always had a reputation as being a rich sleazebag liberal, so the police were happy to go after him. In March of 2015, Harvey invited Ambra Batilana to his office in Tribeca. Ambra is a model and a Miss Italy finalist who was at that point 21 and looking to start an acting career. She met with Weinstein and, surprise, surprise, claims he lunged towards her, grabbed her breasts, demanded to know if they were real, and tried to put his hand up her skirt. Then he gave her tickets to a Broadway show and told her he'd meet her that evening. There you go. She was angry.
Yeah.
Like you'd be. And she went immediately to the NYPD. And the NYPD was great about it. They said, yeah, that sounds like a fucking crime.
Yeah.
Let's do some police shit. So the Special Victims Squad took the case and they asked Amber if she'd be willing to do what's called a controlled call. That's where the victim calls the suspect or whatever and talks to them on a recorded line in the hopes that they'll confess to whatever it is that they did. They never got a chance to do a controlled call because while she was talking to the cops, Weinstein called Ambra. He apologized for his behavior and then asked her to meet with him again in his hotel room.
Wow.
So the SVU guys convinced her to meet with him again, and she was kind of freaking out about this. She didn't really want to meet with him, but they were able to convince her to do it, and they gave her, I think, 2 cell phones to record the conversations with. They met at the bar in the Tribeca Grand Hotel, and Weinstein told her about all the women whose careers he'd helped and offered to pay for a dialect coach. Then he asked her to go up to his room while he showered. She said no a number of times and wound up like going to the bathroom and talking with the cops, and they convinced her to go up with him, recording. But then she stopped outside of the door to his room and refused to go any further. And that's where this conversation happened. And you can find the tape on the New Yorker, but this is an NYPD tape. So we're just going to play that in full. It'll give you a chance to hear what Harvey Weinstein actually sounded like when he was trying to get a woman into a room with him.
I'm telling you right now.
What do we have to do here?
Nothing. I'm going to take a shower. You sit there and have a drink. Water.
Don't drink. Can I stay on the bar?
No. You must come here now.
No.
Please.
No, I don't want to.
I'm not doing anything with you.
I know.
You're embarrassing me.
I'm sorry. I cannot. No, yesterday was kind of aggressive for me. I need to know a person to
be
touched.
I won't do a thing. Please. I swear I won't. Just sit with me. Don't embarrass me in the hotel. I'm here all the time.
Sit with me. I promise. Don't want to.
Please sit there. Please. Mm. 1 minute.
No,
I
can't.
Go to the bathroom.
Please. I don't want to do something I don't want
to. Go to the bathroom. Come here. Listen to me.
I want to go downstairs.
I'm not going to do anything. You'll never see me again after this. Okay? That's it. If you embarrass me in this hotel,
I'm not embarrassing you. It's just that I don't feel comfortable.
Honey, don't have a fight with me in the
hall. Nice.
Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in. On everything, I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Please come in now. And 1 minute, and if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket, you can go.
Why yesterday you touch my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again. Come on. Sit here. Sit here for a minute, please.
No, I don't want to.
If you do this now, you will embarrass me. I know. Goodbye. They will call me again. Okay? Sorry. Nice. I promise you I won't do anything.
I know, but yesterday was too much.
The guy's coming. I will never do another thing to you. 5 minutes. Don't ruin your friendship with me for 5 minutes.
I know, but it's kind of like, it's too much for me. I can't.
Please, you're making a big scene here.
No,
please.
But I want to leave.
Okay, goodbye. Thank you.
Yeah.
That was terrifying.
Yeah, it's horrifying. And you heard that line where he says, I swear on my children's lives. I was just reading, again, another article today where someone pointed out, I think it was one of his assistants actually was being interviewed, and she said that was his go-to line, if any.
To bring his kids up?
Well, to say whenever he wanted someone to trust him that he hadn't meant something or that he hadn't done anything bad, I swear on my children that I would never do anything. Like, that would never do it. Like, that was, like, she said he was constant. Like, that was
there his. There was so much to unpack on that.
Yeah.
Like, 1, 5 minutes, I won't do anything. Like, clearly you're just you're lying. I can't even. The police want her to go in and basically catch him on tape trying to assault her.
Yeah, yeah. They want to get as much as they can on tape.
Which is
a little messed up on their end, too. Because, like, I feel like they probably had enough at that point.
Yeah, because how would she have escaped? You know, like, were they planning on busting through the door and stopping it? I don't think so. There's so much there that is just so fucked up.
Oh, it's about to get fucked-er. So Amber had too much at that point. She left immediately after that call. She didn't go into the room with him. The police felt like they had enough evidence to press charges. So they pressed charges. They took it to the Manhattan DA's office. The DA's office spent 2 weeks, which is a really long time for this sort of thing, investigating the case, and then decided not to prosecute. Now, this may have had something to do with the avalanche of articles that came out in the meantime. So as soon
about
as
her.
About Ambra, yep, in a bunch of
classic
gossip magazines,
Harvey.
Yeah, yeah. It turned out she'd been a witness in a bribery case against Italian President Silvio Berlusconi and an unwitting invitee to one of his bunga bunga parties. You've heard of that?
What's bunga bunga parties?
Silvio Berlusconi is a creepy fuck who would have sex parties, and she wound up at one of those, not knowing what it was, and I think like left. But anyway, she was like a witness in a bribery case against him. She had also previously accused an Italian businessman who she'd had a relationship with, I think, of sexual assault. And I guess the DA decided she wasn't credible enough, that it was just beyond the pale that an Italian supermodel would have had three inappropriate interactions with men in her life, which is like, it seems like if those are the only three times that she's been around creepy guys, I'm surprised.
Yeah, I feel like, oh God, people really don't give a shit about women.
No, and it's likely that the DA probably got cold feet because of a prior high-profile case where Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was a bigwig with the IMF and a French politician guy, had gotten charged with the rape of a hotel maid. They had to drop the charges against him because of issues with the witness's credibility. It's an interesting story. You should read into it. But for this, our purposes, the DA was scared of a repeat. And so like everybody else in this story who enabled Harvey Weinstein, they were frightened for what going up against him could do to their careers, and so they backed down. Ambra understandably lost any kind of faith in the American legal system. She settled privately with Weinstein. As part of the settlement, she was required to hand all of her personal electronic devices over to a company called Kroll. Now, Kroll is a security services company. Their website claims that they're the, quote, leading global provider of risk solutions.
I've heard that name before.
Yeah. What they are is rent-a-spies. And that brings us to the end of today's podcast and is where we're going to start at part two, which is the army of spies that Harvey Weinstein hired and utilized in order to keep his secrets. These are probably the clearest monsters other than some of the people at the Enquirer of this story outside of Harvey Weinstein. And it is... it is quite a thing to unpack. So if you want to join us on Thursday, we'll be getting into all that and finishing up the saga of all the mini bastards of Harvey Weinstein. Until then, I am Robert Evans, and my guest has been...
I am Anna Hosni, and I am horrified.
Mm-hmm. You want to tell the people where they can find you on the interweb?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at Anna Hosnier, AnnaHosnieh. You can listen to my podcast, Ethnically Ambiguous, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. And you can follow my podcast on Twitter at EthnicallyAmb, AMB on Twitter, where we post a lot of information about Middle Eastern news.
You can find me on Twitter at IWriteOK, where I also post a lot about Middle Eastern news. You can find this podcast on Twitter at BastardsPod. You can find our website at BehindTheBastards.com, which will have some terrible pictures of Harvey Weinstein looking like a schlub, and as well as the sources if you want to do more reading for yourselves. So, until Thursday, I'm Robert Evans. Please keep feeling like you're covered in grease, because that's how I feel right now.